The second thing is that the Indians around here were not beaten militarily. Now, I say that after going through an awful lot of records. The defeats were not military. Essentially, Indian people were flooded off their land. They were flooded out by settlers. And the settlers then proceeded to make laws in their own legislature, which they could then enforce because they had the population to do it. And that is essentially why Indian people wound up being a poverty-stricken minority. They were flooded out. There were occasional fights, yes. They give you the massacre of 1622, true. They also give you an uprising in 1644. And all these things did contribute. But there were also other things that contributed. There was a mass taking of Indian land, which has been documented. I told Ray about it on the way up. Well described in the 1670s, just about the time the treaty was made, as a matter of fact, that you all are still living under on the reservations. A very accurate description of how you flood out a whole Indian town and get the people to leave it peacefully and supposedly voluntarily. And you simply do it with manpower and with a herd of cattle, which are hard to drive out of the cornfields once they're in. This is the sort of thing that ought to be brought out. It makes the Indians seem less war-obsessed, which is all to the good. It also makes history seem less to be a series of battles, which is a kind of history that is traditional history. It's the way the Europeans have done it for years. They're trying to do a different kind of history now. And it's more realistic to talk about people dealing with people, not just a whole bunch of fights. One other thing that ought to be brought out about this 1670s period, that's the period of Bacon's Rebellion. A lot of people mention it. What they don't usually mention is that there was a serious amount of scapegoating done on Indians. You can bring Indians right into Bacon's Rebellion. Nathaniel Bacon himself blamed the Indians for all of the ills that were going on among the English. And this has been very well documented. And it's another way to bring Indians into the history books at the 1670s, and it's well worth seeing. It's well documented. There are publications readily available. Wilkham Washburn's A Governor of the Rebels is a good example of this, and there have been others since. Okay. The history books often will tell you that Indian population was vastly decreased by 1700, and things more or less came to a halt. There ought to be a bit of change made there. Yes, the population was smaller, but it was also much more diverse because there were people still living in Indian towns, but they also had relatives living among the English, and a process of Anglicization was taking place very slowly, but it was done through relatives. It was not done by missions in Virginia. It's not like New England at all. There's a real difference here. It's the Whiskeypalian Church, and we're lousy missionaries. I'm one myself. We're lousy missionaries. And they don't set up schools, and they don't set up praying villages, and they don't do all of that. They're too busy out making a buck. So instead, most of the culture change that did come in, A, came in slowly because it wasn't forced, and B, came in through relatives who had been out working for Englishmen and came home to visit, or sometimes came home to retire. It's a process that's continued on reservations right down to the present. And it also helps to keep up a population so that the people don't entirely disappear. They merely change. And that is a major thing that ought to be brought out.
Could we say anything about the English schools they started for Indians during this period?
School, singular, not school, plural.
Yeah, we always see something about that school.
The Brafferton.
Yeah, but
that was an English charity. It did not originate in Virginia, which tells you where Virginians' heads were at. And that can be documented, too. And that's worth seeing. And it was the only school for a long, long time. There was one temporary one out at Fort Christanna. And all of these were run from English funds, not Virginia funds. Christanna folded in a very short time. The Brafferton money was diverted in the American Revolution because the English here rebelled, and the British weren't going to send any more money to educate Indians in Virginia. And Virginians did not pick up the difference until, unwillingly, the late 19th and early 20th century. And there you've got some connection going on through, too.
I was just going to ask about the one that they call it the College of Hammurabi. Do you know anything about that one?
They intended to set up a school there, and it never actually got going. The money was only available in 1619, and they never quite got it organized. And then with the uprising of 1622 and the population getting hit there, they just abandoned the whole project.
I read one account of it said the Indians burned it down before they ever opened the doors. Killed the headmaster.
I don't think they even got a building up, actually. I don't think they got that far.
This one I read said they had a building. The Indians burned it down.
Yeah. It never really got going, certainly.
In taking it into the 20th century, I watched a public television special on the Wicca religion. And they claimed that all witchcraft, their entire beliefs were based on Native American witchcraft. And they showed the dolls, rubbing of the dolls, yes. I watched this the other night and I took notes, extensive notes, because I became very upset because they had religious people in the audience who naturally questioned all of this. And they said, we shouldn't be condemned as wicked because everything that we are doing in the United States, especially from Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Virginia, South Carolina, they had this group of witches who said they had based it entirely on the religion of the Native Americans and their methods of witchcraft. I thought that was unbelievable.
I agree with you.
Yeah, unbelievable. And they're the Wiccas. And
it's pure horse hockey.
Yeah, but nevertheless, the persons that are watching this, who are ready to latch on to something, would take the ball with this and run, and someone ought to write to Hidalgo Rivera and let him know that it's enough that he's on Channel 7. He can stop with the cable special in this area and, you know, go back to looking for Al Capone's tomb or something. But it was quite perturbing.
Think what else? From the same period, actually 18th century, I don't know how much priority ought to get. It's minor, but a lot of people ask me. They ask me why modern Virginia Indians don't still speak an Indian language. And there's a real quick explanation that the public understands if you word it just right. And that is, by 1700, Indian populations were so small, they were a lot of little islands, and if you're going to keep a language alive, you've got to have a big island of people. When you've got a little island and they're having to go outside the community for a lot of service, like blacksmithing, you have to use the outsider's language, and eventually your own language can die unless you make great big efforts to keep it alive. And that is essentially why the Indian language in Virginia died.
Also,
yes, they were.
And there's very little Algonquin language anymore at all. And I think when the United States government was formed in 1776, that generation had said the Powhatan people said to let that language, let it die. And I think when a language dies, it doesn't necessarily die that year, because your grandparents are teaching your children, so the generation could run as long as maybe 80, 90 years. The Algonquin language phased out in about 1850 or so. But they had agreed to adopt English as their language.
Yeah.
But and so at a certain period of time, they said, let it die. But it doesn't die that day. It dies at the end of the grandchild's generation. When they let
right.
it
down. That point ought to be made. And another
so that's
point.
That's why the language was given up. And from what I understand, the only thing close to the Algonquin
I'm not even sure to what degree that's spoken
that's
anymore, is it?
That's
oh, yeah, it's related. The nearest really ongoing speech community in Algonquin that I know about is the Passamaquoddy in Maine. And they've taken in a lot of English words for administrative things. It's become Passamaquoddlish when they're talking government stuff, because I've heard them talk it. Bureau, administrator, all the sort of things. English creeps in. And all that's a natural process. By comparison, it's always useful for Indian folks to point out that Indian folks out west also have got an increasing percentage of their folks who do not speak the Indian language, who speak only English. That's even happening among the Navajo, who are famous for being traditionalists. It's a fairly natural process. If you have got lots of other people coming in and doing things on your reservation, which is happening among the Sioux. And more people have got to have the English, and English gets established. It happened here earlier. It's happening there now. It's always useful for Virginia and Eastern Indian people generally to say what's happening here now is going to be out there in a couple hundred years.
I just hired old Sioux girl.
Did you really?
Yeah, in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Does she speak the language?
You say you have to go out and announce that it's resurgence in the past 15 years, because I know I grew up where I was born and raised.
I remember.
And there was more French that was spoken than there was English when I was growing up, but not the so much the native language. They're restoring that among
Yeah, it's happening among the Ojibwe too. Ojibwe, even in big communities, is fading out.
As far as we know, there was not an official policy of the Commonwealth, though, against Indian language.
No.
Benign neglect all the way through.
They decided on their own to let it
out. Yes. No, mostly the Virginia government took very little interest in what was happening with Virginia. In the early 18th century, we also need to say much more definitely that a lot of these little reservation islands were lost. Sometimes under what looks like suspicious circumstances. The Chickahominy Reservation, for instance, that's the end of that reservation is in county records, which were burned in 1885. So we can't be sure, but the Chickahominy were under very definite pressure. The Rappahannock, likewise. And we don't know the precise end of that reservation, even though the records there for Essex County have been preserved. I can't find when the Indians are pushed off, but it's probably more of running the cattle in and pushing folks away. A lot of these reservations were done that way. And again, when the people were so outnumbered, that's the sort of thing that's going to happen. You get pushed around. And that is why we've got citizen Indians as well as reservated Indians. And that point needs to be made again and again and again.
I would say that if we could do a little more on the citizen Indians, it's my belief that that's how we got lost in all the policy, because of the citizen Indians. The research I had done in my dissertation, there's no doubt in my mind the reason we got lost in the federal policy is because so many of us became, quote, citizen Indians. And so that's a whole area that we need to talk with some of our old folks about, but look at the records too. I guess I'd like to ask, what about the trading with these tribes, with other tribes? Can we say anything about that in the work that you've seen?
I haven't seen many records on trading, not even the fur trade. It doesn't ever seem to have been established as much within modern Virginia's boundaries as it was up in New England, for instance.
But see, we had salt mines that Indians seemed to use over around Roanoke, and we have all kinds of villages there, and I don't know whether there's been any work to show how they relate to the coastal Indians.
Steve Potter's interested in that. It's still ongoing, and it still has to be done in small piecemeal bits. The records don't say much about it, so John's quite right. The major proof of it would be archaeological. With relations with outside Indians in Virginia, again, the English were not that much interested. Unless those outside Indians came in and started killing Englishmen, then they'd take notice and they'd stick it in the records.
Yeah.
So we know about the movement of some of the Siouan tribes. And we know that the Seneca were coming down in the 1680s and zapping Englishmen and Virginia Indians both. And that's most of what you hear about. The historical record is very distorted there.
Is there much in tribal journals and letters relating to that that you're aware of?
I have not been able to get into that many private journals and letters unless they're published. Yeah. That's a whole record collection that I sort of inventoried about 5 years ago.
All
They're not even on the county level. They're in places like the Virginia Historical Society and a couple of societies up in Washington. And it's a lot of reading to do, and it's something that I didn't think would pay off all that much immediately while I was trying to get the books done, so I tabled it.
Those records have a tendency to travel with families, too. And as families migrated to the West, I suspect a lot of those records went with them. It might be beneficial at some
some point to try to branch out further into the West and contact some of the societies out there to see what they might have mm-hmm. that relates to back here, because I've had that experience in doing this type of research.
I looked a little bit at the private collection I have at the Lyceum in Alexandria, the collection of Colonial Day Mrs. Frances Lee, and I must say that the Indian picture was not a bright one. According to their records, you know, how they were defending their lands and et cetera. And she has a really vast collection of some of these, you know, we might get in touch with this. Frances Lee.
Well, I'd like to just flag that because and give someone a special project that could they could bring back to the group. Those Northern Virginia counties have a lot of museums and Indian artifacts, and we should have somebody check that out for us and come back and talk with the group about it and just see if it's from down here or where it's from. I don't really know. I've never had a chance to visit them, but they certainly keep them well.
But it's quite a major undertaking. Yeah. And it means travel, and what it means staying in cities, that gets expensive. And my shoestring wasn't long enough, so I tabled that sort of work for the time being.
Thomas and I are both at Alexandria. The two of us can do something on that and be able to report back because the will of
the
BAL.
And the BAL library, we're over at 16th.
And I've been meaning to really understand that.
But worry about Fairfax and Alexandria.
Fairfax and Alexandria.
They say they have a large Indian collection.
I know that Fairfax has a large colonial collection. I just don't know that they have a large Indian. I know that there's a number of dig sites going on in Fairfax Island.
Yeah, they have the archaeological commission that does that. Mm-hmm. You remember how we were in Berkeley when we did the history of Fairfax, which we had large library.
What I've suggested so far comes from records that I've already collected. I hope you do collect more. That'd be great. Save me all that money. Great. But what I've suggested so far, we can put in from records, and we can also make up document files very, very easily for handbooks and supplements and all the rest of that, because that's precisely the kind of stuff that I've been collecting. To digress for just a moment, I collected in notebooks that look like this. The next meeting that we have ought to be at my house, and you can see the whole study. Because there are several shelves of just solid foam notebooks like this. This is the colonial stuff. On my shoestring, I usually had to copy things out by hand sitting in the library because I couldn't afford the Xeroxing. Sometimes I get rich and Xerox things. But everything I could find pertaining to Virginia Indians, I've simply glommed onto and made copies. And aside from presenting general topics, if any teachers should want handbooks and the like, that they can actually look at documents. Oliver Perry has found in presenting his document packages to people, even if people only glance at the documents, just seeing anything there in black and white, an actual Xerox copy of something, is very, very impressive. So when you can show them the Chickahominy being pressured off their land, for instance, beginning in 1705, and you can actually have a Xerox copy of the page of the executive journals where this is discussed and have that reproducible, can be very, very effective. Or simply having the text of things. This is a Nansemond document file that I've made up. I'll pass it around so you can take a look at it. I've not put in Captain John Smith's stuff yet, so it starts in 1627. And it's got everything since that time that I have found about the Nansemond or they found about themselves. Having this in your tribal archive to select from and make up packages can be a very, very useful strategy in getting across these points that I've suggested ought to be made public. Showing for the language, for instance, when the interpreters were dismissed because so many Indians were able to speak English, and it was very long after the English came. It was like 1734. And showing that the language hung on that long after Indian folks have been stuck on small islands. Little things like that, to Xerox them and ram them home. One of the things teachers really like to see is things written down in black and white. That tends to be Americans generally. If we see it in black and white, it's got to be gospel. So having files to work from, And to select from and then Xerox copies of things can be a real, real useful thing. It's wonderful PR. Pass this around to anybody who'd like to see it. Okay. Still another thing that the Nansemans have found to be useful, they are blessed in having a couple of really old family books. One's a family Bible, the other is a sermon book. And between the two of these, they go back to 1590. They were the property of the Englishman who married the Nansemond woman in 1638, and he was an extremely literate minister, and the sermon book was literally his sermons, and he wrote out longhand. Well, we have made photographs with a 35-millimeter camera. The owner of the book allowed me to come and do this. And from there, the photographs can be Xeroxed. They come out beautifully on the modern Xerox machines. I'll pass this around, too. These are my own copies. You can see what the stuff looks like. They've also got a safe passage certificate of 1797 saying that this man is, in fact, Nansemond and English descent and should not be bothered, etc. Actual handwritten documents in the private sector are useful to make up a package, and Oliver's been doing this. Anything that people can see that's actually there in front of them in reproducible form, it's just fantastic PR, and the more of it that you have, the better off you're going to be. Not only that, but the Nansemonds have gotten a lot of Xerox copies of these, and at cost, the tribe has people buy them and simply keep them in their own home to tell the kids, look, this is your ancestor. And it makes the whole history come alive for the kids. So it's PR right within the family. Pass this around the opposite way. The Nansemonds have been systematically doing that kind of thing. They did it without any prodding from me, by the way. All I said is, if you find documents in the private sector, please let me look at them to authenticate them. And then all this happened on top of it. But it's marvelous PR. All right. For 19th and first half of 20th century, this is the part that the old-timers are really going to be sensitive about, and they've got to do their own selecting. The things I personally think the public ought to know. First of all, the persisting existence of Indians throughout, with reservations or not. And thanks to the courthouse records that oftentimes have been used against Indians, they also show the continuation of actual groups. And they are in marrying groups, and they're very definitely unique. And they're unique to trained demographers. Now, how you get that across to school teachers, I don't know. They may not know what a demographer is. But you've got a group that really does look different from any other group. They associate mainly with themselves. And even before you get tribal churches and schools, which formalizes the whole thing later on, you've got a recognizable group. And there is proof of that. You don't have to get all that specific in the way it's presented. That may allay some of the fears of the old-timers. But the groups are very definitely there. As soon as the county records kick in, you've got some real proof that the group was there. And it's been there. And saying that is very, very well worthwhile. The actual county records, if they've not been burned, usually don't give a lot of personal information about people, and you don't get the marriage registers, and you don't get the death registers where a brother will record his brother's death and you know who's related to whom and all that. You can't really reconstruct a group. We've tried to do it with Nansemon, for instance. It's difficult to reconstruct a group without actually having that kind of personal data, and the counties didn't keep it. They weren't interested in it. They didn't really begin to try to keep it until 1853. So you can't carry the groups back but so far, but it's not the group's fault. It's because the records weren't kept. Now, how much you want to tell the public, that's entirely up to you. But the fact remains, as soon as you get decent records, you can phrase it that way, as soon as the records tell you enough to say whether there's a group there, there's a group there. And oftentimes, they're recognized as Indians. The Upper Mattaponi are. Because here you see these records and the marriage records, and they say, Indian, and old man Plecker didn't get that changed. The county clerk would not change it, even when Plecker told him to do it. So there was a group, and there was a very strong tradition among local people that this was an Indian group. Likewise, when you, what?
Excuse me, are the records available prior to 1853 in the census records?
As Indian?
As Indian.
As Indian, not usually, no. No, they appear in a whole bunch of guys. You've got to know family names. Yeah. But then that's true of Indian people in a lot of states. That's a very, very common thing. And that's worth emphasizing, too, because they're citizens. That was the main reason. By the 1850s, there was this resurgence of interest, a romanticized interest in Indians, but you had to look like Pocahontas. And you had to wear feathers. And you had to talk like Tonto. And citizen Indians who were fluent in English and who were firmly established in Christian churches by that time did not impress the census takers. Now, that can be a little difficult to explain to the public, but it's well worth trying. And therefore, the non-reservation folks are not going to appear in these censuses, which are made by outsiders, as Indians. They'll appear in other guises.
Webster and I had a meeting with the census people for 1990, mm-hmm. and McDowell was very advising us to tell our people, no matter where they live, if they are Pamunkey Indians or Mattaponi or whatever, they're advising us to put that down.
Especially the early census, we have families that are of three different races and sometimes in the same family.
In the eyes of the enumerator, yeah.
Yeah.
And even reservation people will be recorded census. Differently by different enumerators from one decade to the next.
Well, this year.
So you can never trust what they say.
But this
about
year,
race.
The census records are not going to be taken by people. You're going to be sent your.
Self enumerated.
And you
yeah.
return it. And then if they don't get it back within a certain time, then they're going to come back to, like Webster and I would go to the job and see if can't get it straightened out.
You're going to be thrilled. Yeah. Okay. Another thing that the schools might well be interested in is the influence of religion all the way through Indian history, but particularly 19th century, where you get Indian people participating in Southern Baptist, in the case of Nansman Methodist, congregations. And this is a major way of keeping a community together. The conversion to Christianity, it's also worth saying, came very late. From the best records I have been able to find, and the earliest I found are actually about the Pamunkey, the conversion occurred somewhere in the 1780s. Christianity was not immediately deemed by the Indians to be a superior religion, but once they did join it, they got active and they stayed active. In the early 19th century, everybody in a county would go to church together. The history books ought to be saying this already, but they ought to include the fact that Indians, if they lived in the county, were going to the same churches as everybody else. You didn't have segregated churches until after the Civil War. That's when that really started happening. And before that, you get all three races in King William County going to what is now Colossie Church, Upper College Church. But after the Civil War, then you begin to get segregation, and you begin to get a move, funny thing, toward Indian churches. And once the Indian churches got established, they remained a major way of organizing communities and keeping them talking to each other and meeting regularly. Aside from the religious aspect of it, and they were sincere Baptists and Methodists by this time, it was a real social function, and people used it to the hilt.
So it was really 1860, here, you think, when the
65 plus.
That's mm-hmm. interesting. That wasn't yeah. the case in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Not the
it
case.
It was in Virginia. Yeah.
And if you look up at the Wampanoags in Massachusetts, 1676 mm-hmm. is when they built the mm-hmm. first church mm-hmm. For an Indian church. Prior to that time, Indians that had become Christian went to the, as they put, lesser religions, which wasn't Christopher, but rather the Catholic Church or the Congregational Church. And churches.
I would emphasize something else in talking about these incipient tribal churches. The racial climate in Virginia was very anti-non-white, including anti-Indian. This is something that your old folks are acutely aware of, and it causes them a great deal of pain. But the beauty of the churches, thanks to our constitutional right of freedom of religion, you can form a church and nobody's going to stop you. Nobody's going to stick the vigilantes on you. You've got freedom of worship. And I think that's why you find tribal churches appearing before you find really highly organized, formal tribal organizations. And that goes for Pamunkey, too, because you've got only headmen back at that time. You know the list yourself. Right? With a church, you can organize formally, and you can have your own people in it, but outsiders aren't going to bug you about it. And I think that's why you have the churches first, and I think that's why they've always remained very powerful. So that's something worth emphasizing. Another thing for the late 19th century, I have always thought it ironic that early in Indian history, the whites were so eager to educate Indian children and get them anglicized. But after the Civil War, when Indian people became more willing to get the education, the whites didn't want them to have it. There's actually a turnabout. It's a supreme irony. It's well worth bringing out. It's also easy to document. When you begin to have schools after the Civil War, and they began to be public schools, that's the trouble. They're public schools. They're not church schools anymore. Then to have a separate tribal school meant a formal recognition. And the general climate in Virginia was against that. So there's a turnabout. That at least is safe to say in public. Other details may well be very sensitive to your elders and very, very painful. And the illiteracy that persisted for so long, particularly among some of the citizen people, is bound to be painful. You don't have to bring that out, although it is a consequence. The tribal identity in some people was so strong that they would put up with the consequences of illiteracy ever after. They were willing to make what was really a very, very heavy sacrifice. So depending on how you phrase it, it's worth presenting. But this turnaround, this irony, is really, really worth bringing out. It'd be beautiful. Early 20th century, I can't think of anything in early 20th century that's not likely to be sensitive. I practically got an ulcer when I was writing those parts of my book because I was just wondering how things would feel to the Indian people. I think that people themselves are going to have to decide what should be brought out there.